podcast for 8 hours. That's the real question.
You could do like a fans, like a deadline day show, you know?
That would be kind of interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're actually live. Welcome to our little bit of our pre-pod chat there. So.
Oh, God. I wasn't ready.
I forgot to give you a heads up. That was my bad. It's been a little while since I've done this, you know? It's been a really long time since I've done this.
Do you still have it? Do you even still have it?
You have to have had it in the first place to lose something, so I'm not too concerned. I never really set too high of a standard for myself, so I'm not real worried. But last time, my apologies that I was not able to join you and Bill. I had some major technical difficulties. I got on my computer, and everything went haywire. You know how Windows decides that if you don't install their updates right now, it doesn't let you do anything. Well, my computer didn't let me do anything for about 4 hours, and I wasn't about to make those two wait 4 hours just so you could all hear my voice.
I was going to say, we like you, but not that much.
No, I don't think anybody does. Maybe my wife, but other than that, I'm not too sure many people really do.
Yeah. No, but I mean, yeah, it's been a little while even for me. I mean, just, I don't know. It's one of those things when you're an adult, you really realize that free time is not exactly as prevalent as it used to be. Plus we got storms coming through and all that sort of stuff. So it's
and just so people, I'm assuming most people know, but you came through everything okay down there?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. I live in Sarasota, so it was kind of the storm was initially supposed to hit the east coast of Florida. Then all of a sudden we saw it start to head a little more west and north, and so we were kind of at the heart of it. But fortunately, we came out unscathed, no damage, just a couple trees here and there. But all things considered, we got pretty lucky. So definitely count ourselves blessed because there were a lot of people who were, affected a lot more than us. So certainly whatever people can do to help out those people, and then also in Puerto Rico, you should do that.
Yeah, thoughts and prayers for everybody who's still dealing with all that shit down there. It's crazy. It really is. And let's hope that everything gets pulled back together down there. I know people down there are struggling for, well, food, water, gas, electricity, everything. So they're in the best shape right now, man.
Absolutely. So whatever you can contribute, certainly do so. And I know that, sports at least can kind of serve as a distraction to a lot of things going on. But right now, sports is at the epicenter of everything, really. And, you know, just starting yesterday with the college basketball scandal coming out. But I know, Ian, you've kind of got some thoughts on what's been transpiring lately in the sports world, you know, particularly with the NFL.
Yeah, and you guys all know me. I probably get involved, as far as politics go, less than probably anybody else on all of Twitter, not just people who follow me or people that I follow, but I try and stay out of politics as much as possible because you know what? There really is it's a no-win situation, no matter what side you support, no matter what you say, because everybody's always going to come up with some sort of, they're going to come back at you with something. And right now in the way that the political climate is right now, it's just not good, you know? And I know that's a pretty obvious statement, right? Like, oh yeah, the political culture and the situation, it's not good. We know that. And I'm not going to go too deep into any political thing. It's just, there needs to be some sort of middle ground. And again, like I said, I'm not going into my views, but the problem with these protests that everybody's seeing in the NFL right now is that it's devolved into something other than what it should be. You know, people saying that, oh, kneeling during the anthem, that's wrong. Well, kneeling is a position that shows the most reverence and shows that you're honoring something. It goes all the way back. It's always been something. I mean, you kneel to your king. You kneel to, you kneel in front of your, the girl that you hope to make your wife someday. You know, I mean, that's a position that shows the utmost respect and honor. And the fact that the protests have become entirely about is it disrespecting the flag and disrespecting the anthem? That's the problem, right? And really, that's not what they're doing. If you go back to the beginning of it, they're doing it to raise awareness for a political issue. And that's really what needs to be remembered. And both sides of the equation are guilty of causing the issue. You know, there's real serious problems in this country that need to be addressed. And I'm not going to begin to even pretend that I know anything about them. I've been about as fortunate as I can be in my life to not have to deal with those things. And I'm not going to even, it's not something that'll ever cross my mind to even criticize or complain about somebody standing up for something that they believe in strongly. But it needs to become something more than just, oh, they're protesting the anthem. That's not what it is, right? Let's talk about what it is these people are actually not standing up for, but kneeling down for. You know, let's talk about those issues. They're issues that really need to be addressed. And for whatever reason, our president likes to sound off. Again, I'm not going into, is he a good president? Is he not? Whatever. That's for everybody to decide on their own. But it's drawing away from the issue at hand. But also the other side, when you see athletes coming out, with LeBron James calling the president a bum, and other athletes that are coming out, the name calling on both sides, again, it's taking the attention away from the things that really need to be addressed. So the only thing that I really want to say, it's like, people need to have the conversation, you know, like get past the fact that somebody's kneeling during the anthem. Are you really offended that somebody's kneeling during the anthem? I mean, okay, if you are, fine. But that's another conversation. Have the conversation about what it is that these people are really trying to get across. There's serious issues, and really that's just the kind of thing. It goes beyond just that, this particular thing. It's gotten to a point now where it's just so much name-calling, and nobody wants to get at the actual point of the issue. People need to sit down across from each other, have a conversation, listen. Listen to what the other person is actually saying, and don't get offended the second they say something that's different than what you believe or what you feel. Everybody's entitled to their own feelings, their own thoughts. And until we can sit down across from one another and have that conversation without getting offended in finger quotes, because everybody likes to be offended about everything right now, until we can actually have that conversation, nothing is going to change. And, you know, part of the problem is social media, because everything is reactionary. You have 140 characters to say one thing, and so much is lost in that.
Well, good news, that's now 280.
Yeah, right? For a select few, right? Isn't it just for a few people? But you know what I mean? That's I've kind of lost it lately. You know, I've tried to stay out of it, and it's gotten to a point where it's just so incredibly ridiculous that you can't even have a conversation without 17 people jumping down your throat telling you that because I have conservative views, I'm a white supremacist. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, man. How do you even have conversations with people now?
I tend to avoid people when I can, so that's kind of my solution.
Yeah, but, and I
I'm
do too, you know? But you're not, though. You're really not, because I'm the same way. Why do I avoid politics altogether? For what you just said. You know, for what I've just said. But that's a problem, right? You should be able to have that conversation.
Yeah, it's become so easy to kind of brand people one way or the other. But yeah, like you said, and I'm not an avid NFL follower, so I really haven't kept up with what's going on too much, except to the extent that it's kind of front page news. But certainly what you said about having important conversations, I think that's something we need to keep in mind, you know, like not so much about the act, but what it stands for. I mean, people are legitimately concerned and hurt and upset about, you know, the issue of police brutality and things of that nature and inequality. And, you know, they're using their platform to take a stand. And so, I mean, like you said, it's one of those things where there's conversations that need to be had rather than people just digging their heels in and trying to one way or the other just say, well, I know I'm right and you're wrong, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and again, like I said, I don't want to get too political, and I appreciate having a platform that all seven of you out there are listening to, right? Hopefully it's more than seven, but I'm you know, I don't want to say 40 and be overshooting our influence, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So, yeah. No, all right, enough of that. Like I said, I just needed to kind of get that out, because it's just getting incredibly frustrating that those conversations can't be had. So on to something much less frustrating than politics. Arsenal.
I wouldn't say that we're much less frustrating. I think we're
I was waiting for a reaction there.
No, I was trying to quantify like how frustrated they make me. And then I arrived at like a solid like 8 out of 10. That's usually my level of frustration with Arsenal. Whereas with political situations, usually about a 6 or 7. So actually, we managed to surpass that. So that's good news. But
that's saying something, man.
But certainly, it's I don't even know when Bill and I were on. I think it was before the Liverpool game, I want to say. I honestly don't know. So I think it might have been before that, but. It's been an interesting open to the season for Arsenal. I think, you know, you started with a pretty nervy win over Leicester. Then, what is it? You lose at Stoke and then at Liverpool. Did I get the order of those mixed up?
See, that's the thing, man. I don't even know.
Yeah, I
we're prepared. Beat Leicester, lost at Stoke, lost at Liverpool.
Oh, then beat Bournemouth, beat Cologne, drew Chelsea, beat Doncaster, beat West Brom.
So and now we get beat Borisov.
Yeah. I think it's Bate Borisov, right?
See, there you go.
Yeah.
How cultured I am.
So, you know, I mean, obviously, there's really not going to get into the Liverpool game that much. I think we kind of know what happened there. You know, it's one of those things where I think all of us saw it coming based on the way that the squad had been constructed at that point. Then obviously trying to shoehorn a certain player into a position he doesn't play in, and then rearranging other players into positions they don't play to compensate said player. So, you know, after that, obviously the transfer window closed, and I think all of us can all of us can kind of relate to each other in our levels of frustration after that. But, you know, ultimately the squad is where it is. And, you know, we beat Bournemouth. You know, then we did get a win in the Europa League, and it still sounds weird to say that. But I actually kind of want to start with the Chelsea game, because I think that was the kind of a litmus test of where we were. And, you know, it's a place that we haven't won in I think 5 or 6 seasons, I want to say. And honestly, we were probably the better team that day. And I would say it wouldn't have flattered us if we had won that game 1 or 2 to 0. Mustafi had a goal ruled offside. Lacazette missed a tap in that just came at him really quickly after Ramsey hit the post. I mean, all things considered, we were probably the better team. But there were some encouraging things in that performance in the sense that the team was defensively solid and you know, you played people in their right positions and the team actually looked good. Go figure.
All right. And I think the important thing, honestly, and the biggest thing to take out of that for me was what you just said there. We saw some encouraging things. We saw more organization. We saw more team togetherness as far as how we played and the energy that we played with. It was something that, you know, going back to that Liverpool game, I don't know that I've ever seen this Arsenal team come out more flat. You know, there was obviously I'm going to put it on the transfer window itself. I think there was so much, not indecision, but uncertainty surrounding that team. What the hell was going on? I mean, if you figure, if you're in that locker room, right, and you're pretty sure that Ox is leaving and he's in the starting lineup, aren't you, like, looking back, just kind of saying, what, you know, what are we even doing here? What's going on? And not only that, is how many people did you see rumored to be leaving Arsenal, right? So I think once that transfer window ended, that really kind of, it obviously ended that uncertainty and said, okay, this is what we're dealing with. Now let's get to work. And especially in that Chelsea game, and honestly since then, you've seen more of that, right? I mean, it's at least trending in the right direction.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, just the last thing I'll say about the Liverpool game is playing a player that you know you're going to sell to another club against that club 5 days before you sell him is one of the most criminal acts of mismanagement Arsene Wenger's ever committed. So that's my take on that. And that was 3 points. It was 3 points thrown away because you had one guy who didn't care. You had Bellerin at left back, left wing back rather than Kolasinac, and no Lacazette in the lineup. And what you saw there was a combination of those things. And like you said, maybe the kind of the will they or won't they stay nature of the transfer window. But yeah, since then, no, the squad is.
Are you 100% convinced that Arsene was, he knew he was selling Ox to Liverpool at that point?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question that they were pretty certain he was leaving. I'm not going to say it was a done deal, but based on his body language, based on everything that came out afterwards, I don't think anyone could say that, you know, anyone could like pretend that we didn't know, or at least that the club didn't know what was going on. So, you know,
and I definitely don't disagree with that either. I think they knew he was off.
Yeah, and so. The problem with that is like people are like, oh well, you know, it's a loss early in the season, so you have time to make it up. That's not how that works. So 3 points now is worth as much now as 3 points in March or 3 points in April.
Right, and it's not like we've got the play, like there's a playoffs, like there's an
exactly. You don't get a chance to make up that away loss to Liverpool now. So you lost that game, and you know you put yourself in a bind where you're already 6 points behind your main rivals, and so that frustrated me. So, you know, I think the Bournemouth game after that was one of those. All right, let's just kind of get back on track. Europa League, it was good to see some of the young guys get some run, and but the Chelsea game is kind of the one that I was most impressed with, just because for some reason I think we actually match up well with Chelsea. You know, Wenger's kind of had Conte's number, honestly, since he came to the Premier League. You know, looking back, what Wenger won last season away, I mean, at home, they did beat us away, I think, but then we beat them in the FA Cup final. We beat them in the Community Shield, and we got the draw this time around. So, you know, he's done all right against them, all things considered. So I don't know if it's just maybe you can't really draw an equivalency between the Liverpool result and Chelsea, because with Liverpool, we do tend to struggle against teams that really press us from the front, and Chelsea don't press with that same level of intensity, but at the same time, they're more solid in the back, so they're harder to break down. But I mean, can you really draw any parallels with those results and say, oh, well, see, we fixed this one thing, so now we're good?
I don't think it's ever as simple as that. I think that's something you have to see over an extended period of time before you can say, you know, that's definitely good. I mean, look back to some of our shows from last season, right? At what point in time did we say, you know what? Yeah, we fixed this issue. We're good to go. And then we went on a 2 month slide where we won two games. You know, so it's like, especially with this team, you never really know, because it seems like everything just sits on a knife edge with this team, where we can go on a run and play really well. One thing goes poorly and it's like you flip a switch and everything falls apart. Generally for Arsenal, that's an injury, right? And that's certainly got to be something that's a concern for this team still going forward.
Well, yeah, you've lost Danny Welbeck already.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's a...
And Coughlin, but that's not... Shame, man. Yeah. No, I...
The Welbeck's a shame, not necessarily Coughlin.
But, yeah, the Welbeck one was a shame because he's been scoring goals, you know, he's been getting into good positions, and he's just like the ultimate team player in the sense that you can play him anywhere up top and or one of the top three positions, and then he'll make something happen. Coughlin, not as much. You know, obviously we've had Ozil out for quite a while up until last week. So, you know, there's kind of been some things on the injury front. Against Chelsea, what kind of stood out to me, though, was the back three / back five. They looked really solid together. Bar one time that Pedro was in on goal clean, there really wasn't too much else that Chelsea created. So, you know, you got to give credit to Mustafi and Koscielny and Monreal. They, you know, they really kept their shape well. Kolasinac and Bellerin tucked back in when they needed to, but at the same time were able to provide some threat going forward. Midfield-wise, you know, Ramsey really played a very disciplined game. Xhaka, same thing. You know, he didn't get caught out of position as much as he did against Liverpool. There were encouraging things. You know, Lacazette got into some good positions. You know, Welbeck got into some good positions as well. It was more one of those things where, I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to take too much positive out of that because of the bad start to the season, or do you really see something there to build on?
I mean, yeah, there's obviously something there to build on. And like, it's pretty much everything we talked about, right? There's definitely a lot of positives there. And we've kind of seen that, you know, moving forward, some of those positives are still there. But let's be real, we played West Brom and Doncaster since then, right? So kind of looking at our lineup, the next real test we have is Everton in the middle of October. So even if we go and run off wins, a couple wins in the Europa League and then a win against Brighton, Watford, I mean, if we win those games, I'm not necessarily sure that I want to be convinced that we've changed for the better, you know?
And on the one hand, like, this is a really good time to rack up some wins because it is a very easy part of the schedule. Like, let's be honest. Like you said,
it absolutely has to be. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like you said, Everton is going to be a tough one, although they've kind of started the season a little shaky. Really might not get an accurate read on this team until November when you get Tottenham and Manchester City in back-to-back league fixtures. I think Tottenham is home and City's away. That could really kind of tell the tale because we have struggled with Tottenham in recent years. Just the pace of their play and the intensity of their pressing has really kind of given us problems. And then obviously City away, you know, they nicked us last year 2-1, and they've only added to their quality since then. I mean, they're scoring goals for fun. So, you know, with the way United have started the season, like, you can't let these teams build up a huge lead on you. So you have to get maximum points from every game until you play Spurs, in my opinion.
Yeah, I definitely can't disagree with that, because even after Everton, it's Norwich and Swansea, then another Europa League game. But, I mean, really, it's you don't have a true test until you get to those games. So, and even then, it's so hard with this team to know what's real and what's not. I think some of the positives, which is going to be interesting to see what happens, is where we've seen Ramsey kind of get to play a little bit further forward, and we saw that last game at least, and that role there definitely seems to suit him a bit. But how's that going to work if you're going to get Ozil into the team? You know, you can't do that with Ozil and Alexis in there. Want somebody like Elneny starting against City or Tottenham? Do we work Jack Wilshere back into this team? Does somebody like, honestly, the next guy in line, does somebody like Joe Willock start making appearances in there? You know, that's kind of part of why we still have that indecision with this team, right? I mean,
yeah, it's you're also, I mean, you have Coughlin who will be back from injury probably. In a couple weeks, I think. I forget exactly what his timetable was.
Something like that.
So, I mean, you got a lot of guys who can potentially play that spot, but in terms of having the discipline, you know, you need to see it consistently from Ramsey and Xhaka. You know, Xhaka's kind of had a rough start to the season, honestly. You know, he's had some bad giveaways. I mean, for all the pass completion stats, I mean, your eyes can also tell you the story too. And when you see him give the ball away in the middle of the park and then, you know, struggle to chase it back just because he doesn't have the legs, it's kind of a little concerning there, especially when Ramsey's got like gets caught, you know, 70 yards up the field. You know, so there's still some worrying signs defensively. You know, I'm trying to see the upside just in the sense that I think we do have a settled back three now, where it clearly is Monreal as a left center back, you know, and then Koscielny Mustafi as the other two. And then obviously Kolasinac does give you a little bit of added security, in my opinion. I mean, I don't know, for me, he's kind of been my bright spot of the season thus far. You know, what are your thoughts on him and kind of how he's fit into the team thus far?
Without a doubt, he's been the biggest, honestly, surprise for me. I know everybody talked about he was team of the year in Bundesliga, blah, blah, blah. I've been surprised at how quickly he's adapted. And really, he's a tank, so I'm not overly surprised at that part. But the surprising part is what he's doing in the final third. You know, he's providing assists. He's providing goals. It's that for me has been the biggest shock. And maybe that's because I don't see a ton of Bundesliga, and Bundesliga diehards might tell you, yeah, that's exactly what you should have expected from him. And that could just be on me, but that's been my biggest surprise with him. But I think, you know, defensively, I'm really, now that Bellerin and Kolasinac have established themselves as those main guys on the wing at the wing back position, and it's not Ox, I think we have a lot more stability defensively because both those guys are going to be relatively responsible coming back. They do like to get forward, but they're outside backs to begin with. That's their position. So they're used to playing having a defensive side to their game, you know? But for me, the biggest area and it's been that way for a long time with this team, is the center of the pitch, you know, center midfield. Right now we're looking at Xhaka, Ramsey, and Elneny. Those are our first team senior players who are fit. Listen to that. I mean, those are the three. Let's look at everybody, all the other teams, even in the top seven. And where do we fall in? Maybe fifth as far as quality? You know, quality, and I'm not just necessarily talking about your top two guys, but quality and depth of that center midfield position.
Yeah.
Maybe fifth, maybe sixth.
Yeah, especially, you know, when you're looking at the other big teams. I mean, City obviously have Yaya Toure, Fernandinho, you know, Kevin De Bruyne. Well, De Bruyne plays a little higher up, but David Silva obviously playing in that position. And they have other options there. You know, United, Pogba, when he, you know, he'll be fit in a couple of weeks, I assume. You know, they have Herrera, Fellaini, for what he is, I guess he's okay. But they do have some other options there. Although I think a lot of their attack comes from their front players. I don't necessarily think they have the most dynamic midfield, but certainly when Pogba comes back, it becomes that way. You know, Chelsea, I mean, with Conte and Bakayoko, I mean, I think that is a really, I'd be excited about that if I were a Chelsea fan, honestly.
It's athletic as all hell.
It's athletic, sure. But, you know, Bakayoko is also a great passer. Conte has become a lot more intelligent when he makes his runs off the ball. And, you know, and then you have Fabregas, who you can bring in to kind of dictate the play when you need to. You know, so, maybe those teams don't necessarily have a huge edge on us. And I do think as other players get back, maybe you have some options. The question I kind of want to pose to you is, and it's kind of been going around the Arsenal Twitter sphere lately, is the Jack Wilshere issue. How much should you reasonably expect from him at this point? He's never going to be what he was promised to be. I think that's, even for the most ardent Wilshere supporter, I think you realize that. But can he be an effective central midfielder at this point in his career, considering he wasn't starting at Bournemouth regularly? He's never stayed fit, you know, for more than a few months at a time.
Oh man, this is something that really cuts deep for me. Jack's been my guy going way, way back. I think you hit it right there. The biggest thing for him is going to be that fitness. Yeah, he's never going to be that player that we saw absolutely boss Barcelona at 19 years old. Never going to be that guy. He's had too much of his career taken away from injuries. And, you know, we've seen signs that that player is still in there at least a little bit. But as far as what you can count on, man, I don't think you can really count on much of anything. Anything you get from him right now, and even going forward, is just kind of a luxury. I don't think you can. You can't bank on him. You can't expect him to. You can't. And shit, for all we know, Wenger is planning on him being back in the team and counting on him for the second half of the year. I just think that's foolish. You cannot build him into your plans to assume he's going to show up and play 35, 40 games for you. Obviously, he's not going to do that for us this year because he's still working his way back from, you know, back into it. But anything you get from him is just extra, which is part of why I have such a concern in that area of the field because, like I said, it's Xhaka, Ramsey, and Elneny and Coquelin when he's healthy. Right, so that's our four center midfielders. I mean, it'd be great for Jack to come back a bit, but I don't know, man.
Yeah, and the interesting, I mean, you're not going to see Santi Cazorla ever in a meaningful Arsenal game again, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I don't see it. I think, unfortunately, that chapter is kind of closed, but. You know, aside from the four you mentioned, Jack is kind of, and then Jack's kind of the wild card. A guy I'm kind of surprised has not gotten a little bit more of a look in his natural position is Ainsley Maitland-Niles. You know, he played there for the youth teams. He's played there for England. Everyone says, you know, people have watched him way more than I have at the youth level say, you know, he's pretty dynamic as a central, more of a defensive midfielder, good passer of the ball, great range, versatility. So, I guess if you get in a pinch, he's someone who could play there. But, I mean, Wenger doesn't seem to trust him there right now. You know, playing him at left wing back against Cologne and Doncaster. So, it really is those four guys you mentioned plus Jack. And, you know, up top, you do have some options at least. Like, in the attack, you do have options. I know Welbeck is out for a little while, but, you know, you have Lacazette, you have Ozil and Alexis, who have not actually played together at any point, so I'm curious to see how that is. Behind them, you have Giroud, you have Iwobi, you have Walcott. So you do have three guys you can kind of plug in there, even without Welbeck. So I'm not too concerned in that area. I think we have enough versatility to score goals, but it is the ability to kind of cope in midfield that still worries me, especially in games where you're outnumbered in midfield.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Xhaka's lack of athleticism kind of hurts us there too. I really do. I mean, that's when you're outnumbered and one of your guys can, you know, doesn't really move all that well, that makes it even a little bit more difficult. But that's where your wingbacks come in handy in that spot. The weak side wingback kind of filling in to get a little bit of support when your top three dropping and giving you a little bit of support. So there's certainly ways to cover up for that lack of athleticism for Xhaka, but there's no doubt that's the biggest worry on the field. I mean, I'm not really concerned at all about any of the other positions out there. I think we compete with anybody else in the league in those other positions. And sure, maybe I'm being a homer and an Arsenal fan, but I think that we're on even par with the top teams in the Premier League in those areas of the pitch, just that center midfield. And you know, the fact that you touched on Ainsley Maitland-Niles there, when he did get to play in that center midfield role, was it at Doncaster, I believe, or he spent a little bit of time in there?
I think it might have been in the second half of that game. He might have had some time there.
I think that's when it was. Immediately, you saw his intelligence, his movement, his positioning was it's there, right? The kid has everything he needs to be, honestly, be a star at that position. I think his potential is absolutely massive. And I don't know necessarily that, you know, you said that it doesn't, we're not sure that Wenger trusts him in that position, but then you touched on his versatility. For me, it's that, you know, he had to play at left wing back. Who else did we have to play at left wing back in that game? You know, he gets taken advantage of, probably to his detriment, that he is such a versatile player. Because Wenger looks at his team and said, okay, you know, I've got a couple guys that can play center midfield, but Maitland-Niles is the only guy that I can play at left wing back that, you know, considering the people he's planning on resting for the next game, you know? So I think that, honestly, I think that's why we haven't seen him get to play in that position enough.
But then doesn't that potentially get you caught in the Oxlade-Chamberlain trap, where Ox was a guy that could fill in at several positions and then never really got, you know, never really established a consistent place at one?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's absolutely a concern of that for me. But also, I think just based on what I've seen out of Maitland-Niles on the pitch, to me, he shows the intelligence level needed to not have that be an issue. But, right, you have to play a position enough to get super comfortable with it, to where you're not thinking about positioning and everything like that. It's just normal second nature. So yeah, man, that's spot on. It could be. And you know, that, I don't know. Like if that happens, that's going to be an absolute shame, because I think he's, like I said, he has the potential to be phenomenal.
And you know, we're talking about Maitland-Niles. Obviously, you know, we're recording this on a Wednesday. As you mentioned earlier, Arsenal have a game against Bate Borisov tomorrow. And, you know, I'm curious to kind of see what team you would pick for that, given the fact that you have a game on Sunday morning, early Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon in the UK, but Sunday morning here. But you have a night game on Thursday. You just had a game on Monday. You know, I know that I believe that Lacazette, Koscielny, Alexis, and Ozil didn't even travel, I want to say.
Yeah, I'm pulling that up right now just to give you an exact team. But there was, I mean, to me, like Josh De Silva was included in the team for tomorrow.
Yeah, I saw Marcus McGuain was included. McGuain, I think, was included. Reece Nelson, Vladimir Dragomir. A lot of the younger guys were included in the squad, which is, you know, it was cool that they could get a run out. The good thing about our squad is that there's enough depth where we can still put out a pretty decent team, bar right wing back for me, honestly. That's the position I worry about most, because if Bellerin goes down, the whole team is kind of fucked. Honestly speaking, that's the one guy you can't afford to lose. And I would not even let him get on the plane to Belarus, where
for this game. From the Bellerin, Monreal, Kolasinac have not traveled. The squad for tomorrow: Ospina, Cech, Macy, and it's all provisional, so not everybody's obviously going to be there on the sideline for the game. Mertesacker, Holding, Mustafi, Wilshere, Elneny, Maitland-Niles, Walcott, Giroud, Nelson, Willock, McGuain, De Silva, Ekpom, Gilmore, Debushi.
So Debushi's alive, so maybe he'll play.
He is alive. He is alive. That or they have a body double.
I honestly, the way he's looked lately, it would be pretty easy to find a body double. But
it's a skeleton.
I mean,
something zombie or whatever.
It's interesting. I can't really peg how we'll line up. I mean, I know Giroud will obviously get the start. I think it was against Cologne, I want to say. Callum Chambers had started that game, and I actually thought he looked really good, but then he got hurt. I really want to see him get an extended run. I mean, Holding has kind of struggled with confidence issues. Mertesacker, you know what you're getting with him. You know, midfield will be interesting to see kind of how we line up there. I mean, it's, you know, when you go to a country like Belarus, you know you're going to face a very hostile crowd. Very passionate crowd, just because, you know, they don't see teams like Arsenal coming that often. So, you know, you have to put a team out there that can cope with that sort of intensity and enthusiasm. But at the same time, you also don't want to risk tons of key players. You want to get some young guys some experience. So I don't know. It's a tough one. And kind of brings me back to a question I actually haven't gotten to ask you, is how do you prioritize between the Premier League and the Europa League? You know, those are kind of the two primary competitions we're worried about. Obviously, got the FA Cup and the Carabao Cup, but I'm not quite as concerned about those, at least at this point in the season.
For me, there's really no question about what we prioritize. There's no doubt we prioritize the Premier League. I couldn't really give a shit how we finish in the Europa League. I want to see players like Willock and Maitland-Niles and Nelson and Holding, and I want to see those guys get an extended run. Jack Wilshere as well. I want to see them get a run in almost all of those games. I don't ever want to see Alexis, Ozil, Lacazette, Xhaka, Koscielny, Bellerin, Kolasinac, Cech. I don't want any of our top 11 players to ever see the field in a Europa League game. I couldn't care less how we do in that tournament, but I want to see our young players given a chance to play. You know, I want to see him given a chance against not a top-notch competition, but it's a high-level competition.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I fall on it too, is I don't think you should be playing regular starters. I think the Europa League is an opportunity to use your fringe squad players and your young players, you know. Giroud is obviously not going to be starting many games in the Premier League, so this is how you keep him fresh in case you do need him. You play him in these competitions or in the FA Cup or the Carabao Cup. Same with Theo Walcott or Iwobi. Like, I feel like that should be your front three, most likely. Maybe Iwobi's hurt. I don't think he's in the squad.
So maybe put not in the squad, yeah.
So maybe put in Reece Nelson there. But, you know, that's someone to look at. But
you'll get Nelson and Maitland-Niles out wide.
I don't want to see Nelson as a wing back, but it's
he's going to be. We don't have that many wide players in that team. I was just kind of just scribbling down how I thought it was going to line up. You're going to see Maitland-Niles or Mustafi start at one of the center backs, and then it'll be Maitland-Niles or somebody else on a wing back and Nelson on a wing back. You'll get Jack and probably Elneny to start. That's how it's going to line up.
Yeah, I mean, that's very plausible. You know, you just have to hope you go in there. If you get, you know, the result doesn't matter too much. I think you can go in there at least get a draw, though. And then, keep your key guys ready for Brighton and they get 3 points there. And you're going into an international break right after that, too. So Sunday's game against Brighton is actually more important, in my opinion, in terms of keeping the confidence going. And, kind of as we're going into that international break, I actually kind of wanted to go into where you see the league as a whole, the Premier League as a whole, the table. I'll just run through it real quick for you. We got City and United tied at the top with 16 points, Chelsea with 13, Tottenham and Liverpool with 11, along with Watford, actually. And then Arsenal in seventh right now with 10, followed by Huddersfield, Burnley, Newcastle with 9, Southampton, West Brom with 8, Brighton, Everton with 7, Swansea, Stoke with 5, Leicester, West Ham with 4, Bournemouth 3, and Crystal Palace with a big, fat 0 points.
0 points. That's crazy 0 points for them.
Takeaways from the season thus far? Who's impressed you? Who are you considering your title favorite right now?
Well, I mean, impressed. Right now you have to say Watford and Hutter. Yep. Mm-hmm. You got it. Those two teams that are up there, man. That's got to be the biggest surprise, right?
Watford, I knew would take a step up with Marco Silva. I didn't see them starting this well. I mean, granted, we're only 6 games in, so maybe, you know, obviously that's not likely sustainable. I will say I've been very impressed with Huddersfield. They've looked really good. Newcastle looks sharp. You know,
shout out to the American manager over there in Huddersfield.
Oh yeah, yeah. We got David Wagner at Huddersfield, and really excited to see how he does, because, and he's already lasted long, almost as long as Bob Bradley did, right?
So, gotta be longer, I think.
I think he has one or two games to go before he catches them.
He's never got more points than Bob O'Head.
Oh, well, to be fair, you or I could probably coach seven games to get as many points as Bob Bradley had. Yes. You know, you do look at the top five, and they are our main competition: City, United, Chelsea, Tottenham, Liverpool. You know, I will say this: for as much crap as Arsenal got to start the season, like, and how much we were struggling, Liverpool and Tottenham are only 1 point ahead of us.
Chelsea's only three. But you know what? Those teams are 100% definite title contender. Jesus, I can't talk. See, I lost it. 100% title contenders, and we're in crisis, as always. But you know what? You're right. We are in crisis, and we're still only a point behind you two. So what does that tell you about our club versus their clubs?
Big, little.
Sorry, guys.
I mean, we are judged on a different barometer, it seems. So,
there's no doubt.
I guess with City and United, I get the hype this early on because they both looked really good. As much as I hate Jose Mourinho, and as much as I hate the fact that they just spend massive amounts at both clubs and you know, get credit for how amazing they are, they have looked really good and cohesive. And first time those two play each other is going to be, you know, must-see TV this season. But the problem is, you know, you have this six-point gap six games into the season. You know, you already put yourself in a hole. And I know I kind of sound like a broken record, but just if you really want to be a title contender, you can't let yourself fall behind basically two wins from another team. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. But that's what we do, right? And we make a historic run in the last month and a half of the season and not quite get there. It's the typical Arsenal storyline or season storyline, right?
With different variations of it, but the same end result. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It all ends up with us finishing somewhere between third and, I'm going to say what, third and fourth, fifth. But I think back to your question after a long winded deviation from that, The league as a whole, top of the league, it's impressive, man. It used to be nice when you didn't have to worry about Tottenham and Liverpool, and you had City, United, us, and Chelsea up there. And it was going to be those four in the top, just some combination of that. But now Tottenham and Liverpool have made – they've really closed that gap. Still lacked that. I know I said all last year was eventually going to catch up with both of them, and it never did. They've got depth. So I think it's going to be difficult for them to go an entire full season and be able to maintain that they play at. I think one of the big benefits for us is that we are playing Europa League. We can rest our guys midweek. And so our slight lack of squad depth isn't going to hurt us quite as much as that might hurt them, you know?
Yeah, and with Tottenham, you do have the Wembley effect, you know? And there's obviously something there, because I think that you've seen a correlation with their results, that they struggle there. The slightly wider pitch makes it hard for them to kind of press and you know, come at you with their physical foul them until they call it style, you know?
Yeah, it's you're right, man. It's definitely deeper than more prevalent than just like a psychological thing, right?
There's definitely
a tactical disadvantage to them playing there.
Yeah, like at White Hart Lane, I think the field is a little bit, the pitch, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's a little bit narrower. And it kind of allows them to kind of get in your face because you have less space to move out of, you know, to play out of it. And to their credit, they took full advantage of that. And the fact that referees don't book them for dives ever, you know, but that's another story for another day. But kind of for where
they have Dele Alli and the boys that, you know, Yeah, can't do any wrong.
Exactly. I mean, I guess the moral of the story is just buy, you know, get yourself a few really good English players, and the media will hype them up and let them get away with anything. Although, to be fair, yeah, Harry Kane has kind of made that transition to world class for me.
He has. I just don't want to give him the credit publicly. Why do you think Arsene tried to develop around an English core?
I'm sure that might have been a secondary reason, honestly. You know, get a little
that
bit
may
of,
have been a primary reason, let's be real.
To get, well, at least to get some of that favorable treatment. You know, you never know, but kind of looking at the
conspiracy theorist over here.
Yeah, but looking at the table kind of right now, who would you kind of peg to win the league, top four, and your relegation teams? I mean, I know, granted, we're six games in, but, you know.
City, United, Chelsea, they're going to slug it out all season for that top three. Us, Liverpool, and Tottenham are fighting over that fourth spot. It's really what it's going to come down to. I think between the three, you know, us and Tottenham and Liverpool, it's going to come down to who's going to stay the healthiest, which means we're probably going to finish sixth if that's the case.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility.
If the past is any indicator on the future, you know, they're going to stay completely healthy all season long and we're going to lose half our team.
Would be pretty fitting, wouldn't it?
I'm being a little facetious, but, you know.
But you're kind of not, though.
A little, yeah. And that's definitely how it's going to fall out. I think those three clubs have shown a superiority to everybody else. I mean, even if you look at the goal differential right now, City's this is kind of astounding. In six games, City is plus 19. Ugh. Plus 19. They're winning on average by three goals a game. More than three goals a game. 3.3. I'm not good at math, but you get the idea. United is plus 15. Plus 5. Liverpool is plus 1. We're plus 1. That shows a bit of a gulf in again, six games in, we've played. You haven't played the same competition, so that's really a difficult thing to say. But it just kind of gives you a window into where those teams are compared to everybody else.
Yeah, right. I think right now I'd probably say City, Chelsea, United would be my top three. I'd probably, at this point, if I'm just going off of what I've seen, I'd probably say Liverpool are going to finish sixth, and between Tottenham and Arsenal and Spurs for that fourth and fifth spot. Relegation teams, man, you can't start much worse than Crystal Palace have. I think Bournemouth are in real trouble because they just can't seem to score goals. And I'd say between Brighton and West Ham to go down as well. West Ham, you would think that they have enough quality not to, but I don't know. They just don't look like a cohesive unit. And Brighton, I candidly just don't know much about them. I know that they picked up 7 points to start the season, which isn't bad, to be fair. But they're -2 goal differential. They don't score tons of goals. But I guess the plus side is they're also not conceding many. But where do you kind of see that one unfolding?
Yeah, I mean, the lucky thing for Crystal Palace is right now they are only six games in, and 5 points gets them out of the relegation zone. Completely safe. And when you look down there, West Ham, Leicester City, though they're not both going to be there all season. West Ham will spend more money in January if they have to get out of that hole. Leicester, I'm surprised that they're down there right now, but they've got some quality. They've got enough quality where, I mean, even just a couple guys with quality enough to keep them out of the bottom three. Stoke is going to be on that line most of the year. Swansea is going to be back down there on that line most of the year. Yeah, probably Brighton. ultimately, I think you end up seeing Bournemouth, Swansea, and Brighton going down. But, you know, like you said, there's still so much to go. But I think those are – you're going to see maybe five or six teams really battling it out all season for that to try and stay safe.
Yeah, and you know, certainly we're coming up on an international break, so some of those teams – especially down on the lower end of the table, their guys aren't going on international breaks, so they might be able to rest up a little.
Yeah.
But speaking of international breaks, I mean, we're also Americans here, so we've got to talk about the old U.S. men's national team and kind of struggling right now. You know, they pulled out a big result in Honduras, getting a late draw with Bobby Wood, nicking a goal. But, you know, certainly qualification is no guarantee. We do have the easier of the fixtures left, but kind of your thoughts just on the program right now, where it's at, Bruce Arena, and just kind of your overall thoughts, and then you know, so we can transition into kind of what we think about the squad moving forward, and then a certain former player turned analyst turned hot take moron.
Yeah. So right now, I think kind of a hot take kind of question for you. We'll see where you're at, and then I'll kind of go into where I'm at. Has the U.S. national team ever been worse off than we are right now?
In my
in our recent memories in the last, say, 12 years, I know, ever.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Just from a, like, people say, well, we have such a deep talent pool, and
well, those people are idiots.
I think what people you're right, but what people confuse is, you can have a wide talent pool, it doesn't mean it's deep. You know, you can have a talent pool the size of the ocean, but if the ocean's 1 foot deep, it's not, you know, that's not deep then. So you can
have 1,000 potential players, but if your best player is no better than me, then you're screwed.
Exactly. So, you know, from a talent perspective, I mean, we're still playing guys like Graham Zusi at right back. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're still trying to plug Clint Dempsey in. You know,
surprised they haven't brought Landon back out of retirement again.
Lord knows they probably tried. You know, we still are relying on Michael Bradley in midfield. Josie Altidore, for some reason, still plays regularly. I mean, I know he's got his goals for the U.S., but, you know, for most countries, a player of his caliber would not be playing as regularly. You know, and even players that I really like Bobby Wood, let's be honest, he plays for a struggling Hamburg team. He's not exactly tearing it up. Or, you know, DeAndre Yedlin plays for a Newcastle team that's not particularly special. So, you know, you do have players abroad, but really how many are making a major difference other than Christian Pulisic? You know, you could argue Jeff Cameron at Stoke, but even the goalkeeper position, which was a U.S. trademark for so many years, there's really no one shining right now. You know,
we're still rolling Tim Howard out there.
Yeah, like for some reason, Tim Howard's still there, and it kind of brings me to something Bruce Arena said. He said something to the effect of like, oh, well, you know, for World Cup qualifiers, we're not going to change the squad because it's just not the right time or something like that. Or, you know, basically this idea that we have to stick with the status quo because they have experience. And this idea of experience is always kind of confuses me, because the only way to get experience is to put players in positions to get experience, you know? And just the fact that someone has played in a bunch of qualifiers doesn't necessarily mean they're going to help you win a game or they're going to be successful in that position. You know, the idea of experience is only really helpful when combined with actual ability. You know, I mean, I could do something 50, 60 times. It doesn't mean I'm necessarily good at it. It just means I've done it a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And absolutely. So, you know, it's kind of this idea that kind of sticks in my, you know, kind of bothers me that there's such a status quo in U.S. soccer and no one wants to mix it up or change anything. Why not give Matt Miazga a chance? You know, why not? He's been doing
an MLS player.
Well, he was, though, so maybe there's a caveat there. Like, but now he's tearing, you know, he's starting regularly at Vitesse in the Dutch league. He's playing consistently, doing well. Why not give a guy like that a chance? I was going to say Danny Williams, but to be fair, he is injured right now, so not him. But when he is healthy, or, you know, there are other guys, Weston McKennie breaking through at Schalke right now. That's huge. You have a young American central midfielder who not only is started playing, you know, first team games for Schalke, he just got a contract extension today, which means that club thinks really highly of him. You know, why not bring him in, see what he can do? It can't be any worse than watching Dax McCarty run around pretending like he's doing something.
Right, but we knew when they brought Bruce in, we know what they brought him in to do. There's no doubt about it. The narrative was all pro-MLS. They brought him in because they wanted to, after we qualified for the World Cup, and watch it. It's exactly what's going to happen. The second we qualify for the World Cup is going to be, hey, look, we were right. We brought Bruce in. He featured MLS players. We qualified for the World Cup with MLS players. It's going to happen. There's no doubt in my mind. And that's why they brought him in. Because U.S. soccer exists to boost up MLS. That is what it exists for in its current structure. And that's completely fucking ludicrous.
And it's funny because a bunch of other people I follow on Twitter have kind of come out with similar sentiments lately. And you know my feeling on that subject. Just going back to what you said about bringing Bruce in. I mean, the revisionist history is remarkable. Like, okay, we lost at home to Mexico, and then we lost away to Costa Rica. So conceivably, you played two of your three hardest games. Yes, and you lost them. But it wasn't like, you know, you lost to Honduras or Panama or something like that. But those two games are what got Klinsmann the sack. All of a sudden, Bruce comes in. You know, yeah, he got the draw at the Azteca. You know, big deal. So did Jurgen. And then, yeah, he got results against teams that Jurgen beat last cycle anyways. And then once we hit a little turbulence, then all of a sudden the savior tag comes off. And, you know, it is one of those things where you wonder if Bruce's allegiance is to U.S. soccer or to MLS, you know, or because of how interconnected they are, it's probably this one and the same, honestly.
Exactly, right? His allegiance to U.S. soccer is his allegiance to MLS.
You know, and again, it's not one of those things where I'm trying to bash MLS, but I think even a lot of people that I follow on Twitter who are ardent MLS fans, and that's awesome, you know, like what's going on in that league and Atlanta United and teams like that really shining and you know, bringing a lot of young star quality. But I think that connection, like you said, where MLS is, I mean, the U.S. soccer seemingly makes it their mission to boost MLS and, you know, somehow talk it up at every moment or make sure that the MLS players get featured.
But you know what, though? I think in all fairness, we've probably been a little bit harsh on MLS as a whole. You know what I mean? Like, okay, put it this way. For me, yeah, MLS isn't really the quality that I like to watch, but I'll tell you what. I don't have time to watch EPL, Bundesliga, MLS, pro football, college. Like, I don't have time to watch all the stuff I want to watch. You know what I mean? So yeah. When I have time to watch one league, I pick what I think is the best. That doesn't mean MLS is the worst. And I think at least me personally maybe has kind of come off a little bit that way, is that MLS is terrible. It's not terrible. It's decent soccer.
No, it's improving too. Like, and it's like you said, though, it is MLS struggles from the fact that it is a market that is heavily in favor of the consumer right now. In the sense,
dude, but what did they do? They put their game of the week, on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, and put it on Fox. Sunday at 2 o'clock on Fox.
Was it on Fox or was it on ESPN?
It was on Fox.
Oh, geez.
At least here. because yeah. I'm in Buffalo, you know, I'm a Bills. We get the Bills game on at 1 o'clock on CBS. So we don't get a second NFL game in the early window because our game is in the early window.
Oh, the blackout. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they were up against an NFL game at 2:30, 2 o'clock on a Sunday.
Yeah. It's just not smart planning.
No,
but here's the thing though. So if let's say MLS games they're going to be played on weekend. On Saturday mornings, you have Premier League games. You have La Liga games, although La Liga games tend to be towards the afternoon. You have Bundesliga games in the morning. You have Serie A games. Starting from 12 onwards on Saturday, you have college football. And for those who don't know me, I'm a diehard Florida Gators fan, so it's kind of been a rough season for me so far. Not record-wise, but in terms of viewing quality. But I digress. You've got college football from noon onwards on all the major networks. ESPN, CBS, NBC, ABC. And then Sunday, like you said, you have the NFL, which is a brand. It's a legitimate national brand that where do you find? It's like you said, to watch all that and then to watch MLS is really tough. So I think what you said is a great point in the sense that, yeah, we come off as we're bashing MLS sometimes. I don't think we're bashing. I think we bash how much U.S. soccer is dependent on MLS and vice versa, and how much media types and coaches think they need to go above and beyond to defend MLS. I mean, I try to watch it when I get a spare minute. Candidly, I can't find the games most of the time. I'm just being honest.
That's another huge problem. There really is no doubt about that.
Right. There was some game on tonight. I think it was Montreal versus NYCFC or something like that. And I was looking on my TV and I could not find it anywhere, you know? And I think a lot of viewers suffer from that.
And let's be real. If I watched another game more than I already do right now, I'm not sure my wife would be overly happy with that.
That's also, it's right? It's like, not even an, I'm not know, sure. It's, I am sure yeah. She wouldn't be happy.
And now I've got the hockey season starting a week from now. Like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I got to figure something out. Right? It's a thing. It's a crowded market. And so I just don't know where MLS's place is with that. Excuse me. But sorry, I'm dying. I'm literally dying on the podcast.
Yeah, it's all right.
No, but
he's actually falling off his chair now, and I don't know what's going on over there, guys.
Yeah, no,
may have just lost Alex. No, really, before we kind of run out of time here, you wanted to touch on one thing before we get to our favorite person in the U.S. soccer media. Right now, currently in the hex, let me get the standings real quick. Mexico, Costa Rica, Panama, US, Honduras, Trinidad, team 15, 10, 9, 9, 3, respectively, as far as points. Two games remaining. Panama is a point ahead of us in the last guaranteed qualification spot. It's that third spot in the group.
I believe so.
I believe that's correct. They're one point ahead of us. They happen to be the team that we play on Friday, October 6th, Panama. We play Panama, Trinidad, and Tobago for our last two games. And then, let's see, Panama has us and then Costa Rica. Tougher schedule for them to close out the group. But that game on Friday, the 6th, realistically is going to determine who gets that last spot.
Yeah, no, I would.
How do you think this plays out?
I think based on the way the schedule is kind of unfolded and the games we have left, I think the U.S. are in a good spot. Based on who Honduras have, and then also obviously getting Panama at home, I think the U.S. should be able to grab that third spot. If you don't, though, and you get that fourth spot, you end up playing, I want to say you end up playing Australia. Someone had mentioned that, because you play someone from a different region in the tiebreak. So, no, you play Asia's fifth place finisher, I have no idea who's in.
Team that finishes fourth will play the fifth place team from Asia over two legs.
So someone mentioned that might be Australia. That would be no gimme for sure. You know, because they have players playing in Europe certainly, and you know, not maybe at the to the extent we do, but you know, it's one of those things where I think the schedule's set up well enough for us to survive. But if you don't beat Panama, let's say you get a draw in that game and Honduras pulls off a win, all of a sudden that game at Trinidad and Tobago becomes a lot more complicated.
I pretty much will get 3 points in that Trinidad Tobago game. So what that's going to bring right there, that we would get that. I don't know, man. Will we end up qualifying for the World Cup? Yeah. We'll qualify above the fifth place Asian team. I don't doubt that. But if the last round of games is any indication on how we're going to show up, us and then a draw, if that's any indication as to what we're going to do, I'm sure as hell not comfortable.
Yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibility that we don't make it. I'll put it that way. But I would be remiss if I did not mention something I haven't got a chance to talk about, at least on here. So several weeks ago, U.S. Soccer Zone Skip Bayless, aka Alexi Lawless, went on an MLS halftime, and he called out the U.S. men's national team, and I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched a few seconds at first, and I had tweeted, "Oh, I'm glad Alexi's finally calling out some of these guys." And then I listened to him, and it was without a doubt the most choreographed, prepared, theatrical, yet absolutely lacking any substance performance I've ever seen in terms of sports television. Basically, I'm going to paraphrase here, so this is not exactly what he said, but he said, "Oh, Tim Howard, the Belgium game was 3 years ago. We need you to stop shots now. Jeff Cameron, we need you to do your job or we'll find someone who will. Michael Bradley, we don't need you to be zen. We need you to play better. Josie Altidore, is this your best? Because if it is, it's still not good enough." And then he said, "For all the guys I didn't mention, Clint Dempsey, you need to be a leader," something like that. And he said, "For all the guys I didn't mention, it's because you don't even warrant being mentioned. And that includes you, Wonder Boy." So to unpack all that,
I think you pretty much hit that spot on.
I think I got it in the right order too.
It's almost like that little tirade kind of sunk in, and you know,
well, because once
burning
once,
hole in you once, in a real while there.
Oh, you have no idea, man. What once I heard it, because you and I both know, like he's a character. He is,
well, like you said, the words you used was theatrical.
Yeah,
right.
It was a performance. He himself has said he is a character. He says things that he says to get a reaction. But the problem is, and I fall prey to this too, I know he says it to get a reaction, and I still give him the reaction. But there are other people who actually listen to him and think, this guy is so genuine in what he's saying. Oh my God, he's being critical. No, he's not, because MLS is the hand that feeds him, and you know, U.S. Soccer is the hand that feeds him. So he's had a vested interest in not being critical of people in the system. You know, he's the same guy who said Sunil Gulati has done a great job and this and that. So, you know, when you actually delved into the substance of what he was saying, he wasn't saying anything substantive. And that's what some people pointed out on Twitter to me after I initially posted that, "Oh, I'm glad he was critical." But people are like, "No, he didn't actually say anything." Telling Tim Howard, "Oh, you need to stop to save shots now." Well, no shit. That's what a goalkeeper's job is. Telling Michael Bradley he needs to play better. And then the Wonder Boy shot at Christian Pulisic. Like, how dare you? Like,
well, you talk about reaction, man. That's the thing. That's the biggest reaction that I saw the entire time. Was, "Oh, how can he be criticizing him? He's the only player that can do anything. Oh, this kid's overrated, blah, blah, blah." That one comment. Just throwing Wonder Boy out there.
Well, I watched something. He said something after. He was like, oh, well, we say that our media is not critical enough of our players, but then I call Pulisic Wonder Boy and people get mad. I'm like, people don't get mad because you did that. People are confused because you're calling out the one guy who doesn't deserve to be called out. You can call out everyone else on that team, but don't call out the one guy who's actually playing on a team that matters, in a league that matters, at a level that matters, you know? At a level that no one else on our team can play at. And you know, you and I are both huge Pulisic fans. We see his upside while acknowledging he's still a work in progress, but he's still miles ahead of where we are. So you want to call out Michael Bradley? Yes, please do, because he's not been good for about 4 years now. You want to call out Jozy Altidore? That's fine too. I don't have a problem with that. But provide like genuine substantive analysis, not just these talking points that you're yelling on TV to get a reaction. I'm not trying to get too ranty and go off on a huge tangent. I mean, you obviously saw the comments too. What did you think when you heard them? Was it just, oh, this is more of the same from Alexi?
It was the same kind of thing. Flipping through Twitter, saw, oh, Alexi Lalas finally criticizes U.S. players. I was like, what? Like, is this an Onion article? Like, I don't know. Let me look at this. And I heard his rant, and I was like, no shit. He finally said something. And like you said, watch it through a second time. Think about what he actually said. And it was like a caveman, Bradley played good. Like, I mean, really. Even like you said, I'm pretty sure – like, that's a quote of what he said. Michael Bradley, you need to play better.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they pay you the big bucks.
Wait, Alexi, you're our number one. He is the number one soccer analyst on TV in America. There's no denying that. He's our number one guy.
In terms of people knowing who he is, at least, yeah.
Not necessarily even that. It has the most exposure. He's always the one that's on TV. He's always the number one analyst voice you hear. Soccer. At least he's the number one person that I see. There's a lot of other voices out there, but he is always the number one voice. And this is what we're getting from him? I mean, we shouldn't expect any different. Like you said, he even said he's a character. He's all about theatrical. He's all about driving conversation, if you will. But it comes from the state that the U.S. sports media really is in right now anyways. Is so much of it is about being theatrical and driving clicks and embracing debate, as ESPN would put it. Really the same spot you said. Once you actually looked into what he said, you realize he said nothing at all. I mean, he's been saying he touched on a couple things that we've been saying for 4 years now. Michael Bradley, you need to be better. Jozy, what are you like? It wasn't anything groundbreaking. It was a waste of time. It was blown up to, you know, make the MLS's golden boy act like he was criticizing the MLS, and 70% of the people out there fell for it.
Well, and it's interesting because Craig Burley on ESPN a couple days prior on the ESPN FC show, and I don't watch it that often, but I think Burley can be annoying, but he was way harsher on the U.S., basically saying, like, we're afraid, you know, soccer media here is kind of complicit. Like, we're just so afraid to criticize U.S. players, and the level here is nowhere where it needs to be. And a lot of fans like really agreed. And it was like the first time there was like this swelling of opinion, even amongst casual fans, like, no, what we're watching isn't good enough. And then I think Lalas, you know, cause he's a smart guy and he kind of took stock of this, and I'm not going to take credit for this idea. I was listening to the World Soccer Talk podcast and they kind of mentioned this, and it was a good point that I think Lalas saw where the public opinion was swaying, and he's like, I'm going to jump on this so it looks like I was right at the forefront. But really, it's just that Burley kind of at least pointed things out to people, and then other people were like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. This isn't good enough. And then Lalas is like, wait, no, public opinion is going that way. I'm going to go that way too.
But you know what? Is that his type of analysis though? And I don't know this, and I'm not saying this is the case. Is the U.S. soccer fan base, is U.S. soccer culture, is it intelligent enough to really take in that kind of criticism? You know what I mean? Is it, are we as a soccering nation, a footballing nation, as fans, are we intelligent enough? Do we know the game well enough to understand and recognize intelligent criticism when we see it?
I mean, I can't say the whole community is there. I think there's a growing base within the community, yes, but others not quite there. No, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah. I for me, there's a certain percentage of it, and I'm not even going to try and put a number on it, but there's a certain percentage of it that, yes, absolutely, those people definitely understand that part of the game, and they can understand that type of criticism. But I also think, because, you know what, it is still relatively new. There is still a groundswell of a fan base that's growing, and, you know, it takes time to educate those people. Right, it'd be like all of a sudden lacrosse gets super, super popular in the U.S. Or, okay, let's put it this way. All of a sudden cricket starts growing in popularity in the U.S. I wouldn't know what the hell anybody was talking about. It takes time. I know soccer because I've played it my entire life. I've coached it. My dad was a coach. My dad was a college player. Like, we've grown up in this game. But for people that haven't grown up in the game and haven't necessarily had – that kind of an exposure to it, they only know what they've seen on TV. I think that's the vast majority of the people that are following U.S. soccer at this point in time. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not criticizing. It's not their fault. I just think U.S. soccer media has to do a better job of educating people. But if they did, they would learn that MLS isn't where it needs to be and it sucks and they'd stop watching. Okay. You know where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
There's an agenda. It's like some right there.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, because there's so many ties between the U.S. soccer media and MLS, there's a hesitancy to be too critical of MLS, which in turn leads to a hesitancy to be critical of the U.S. soccer setup and how we develop players. You know, we could go on and on about that, and certainly there's enough there for future podcasts. But, you know, for the time being, obviously the two big games coming up are against Panama and Trinidad, and we'll see where we're at after that. You know, hope that we qualify, and if not, then we're going to have a completely different tone on the next one we do, I'm sure.
I will. You want to see some fireworks, man.
No, the hot takes will be spewing from both of us if that happens. But, you know, just definitely felt good to get back on here and talk some Arsenal, some U.S. soccer, and you even hit the politics a little bit today. So
yeah, I know that's not really what we do, and that's not something that we're ever going to do too much of, and I'm sure I rambled like crazy, but
no,
I appreciate the forum to kind of to get that out here a little bit.
Yep, and if you want to direct any complaints to Ian, it is at GunnersFan6.
I forgot to put the disclaimer. Before I said anything, don't at me, bro.
Oh, God. but, yeah, so, I mean, let's be real. It's just a tough time in sports right now. Everything you're hearing is negative. This college basketball thing is going to get worse before it gets better. But so I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about on a lot of fronts in a couple weeks when we get back on here. But – so once again, you can find Ian at GunnersFan6. You can find myself at UFGoonerAJ on Twitter. You can find the podcast at EuroSnobPod, Facebook.com/EuroSnobPod.
And what the thing I will tell you, now that we're getting back into this, I've figured out my new job situation and schedules and starting to get a better feel for all that stuff. You're going to start seeing us being more active out there. The podcast account's going to get more active. We're going to try to have this out for you, recorded Wednesday nights, published Thursday morning. that's going to be the ideal schedule.
Yeah.
So unless, you know, count on that, count on seeing new episodes either late Wednesday or relatively early on Thursday. That's our goal. So we want to keep this back, get this back to being on a regular schedule here, and keep some content moving out here for you guys.
Yeah, and hopefully we can also get back into the writing, because I know we kind of dabbled in that early last season, but I think...
Did anybody actually read that?
I was hoping. I mean, I read it, but I also wrote some of it, so that's kind of why. But
I read it because I had to post it on the website, right, and make sure that you goons didn't misspell stuff.
Exactly. But
so spell checks for everybody. I actually don't know how to spell myself, so...
That's what it's there for. It serves some purpose, right?
But absolutely.
But yes, like Ian said, we're going to try to get this more regular. And you know, sometimes life just gets in the way. Let's be honest, we're all adulting now, and it's rough.
We're trying to, at least, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's so. But Ian, any last words for the folks before we sign off?
No, man. Go Arsenal. Let's qualify for that World Cup, US, and. Yeah. Come on, you there, Gunners.
There you go. All right, folks. Have a good one.
All right. Peace.